So I want to spend a few minutes introducing the LePage Center and what we do there, and talk just briefly about entrepreneurship. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are interested in entrepreneurship? Right on. But I notice it's a minority of you. So I'm going to try and convince you in just a few minutes that you want to join the folks that just raised their hands and to be more interested in entrepreneurship. So the LePage Center and entrepreneurship. A lot of times people talking about, when they think about entrepreneurship, it's like, how do I live really hard for a few years in a way that most people don't, so that I can spend the rest of my life doing what most people can't? And I think that's kind of right. When you're an entrepreneur, you're doing your own thing. You're making your own business. You're making your own world in a whole lot of ways. And you're not doing it the way other people are doing it. Otherwise, you'd be working for a different company or doing other things. But I would argue that part of that, why you do that, is so that you can keep doing it, so that you can keep living the way that you want to live, and spend the rest of your life living the way that you want. Not necessarily the way that other people can't, but the way that you want, the way that you want to live, build the types of things that you want to build. So thinking about entrepreneurship as basically a way to do what you like, to not actually have, you know, there's the old cliche, if you're doing what you like, you're not really working. Right, because if you're really working at what you want, you're building stuff that you really care about. And so entrepreneurship as a sort of idea, this idea of working towards what you're really interested in and building what you really want, and that's what we try to build and try and sort of teach you some skills so that you can do that in our programs. So the Global Innovation and Entrepreneurship Minor has just four classes. So two of these you already have to take as business majors. So basically, to have this extra minor, you only need to take two more classes. So the marketing class that you all have to take, that's part of the minor. The entrepreneurship class that you all have to take, that's also part of the minor. The innovation and design thinking is part of the minor that you have to add on. But you learn how to build. You learn how to design and think about hard problems and build stuff in a sort of iterative way, which not only works as an entrepreneur, but it works wherever you go. It's a skill that you can take anywhere. And the last one, the GIE Practicum, the Global Innovation and Entrepreneurship Practicum, that's a course that I generally teach. And the idea in that class is to theorize, what on earth are we talking about when we're talking about entrepreneurship for real? And what is innovation really? And not only what is it theoretically, so we come up with some theories on our own. We come away with our own theories of how these things should be thought about, but then we test them by going to a foreign country for 10 days, talking to CEOs, talking to startups, going to incubators, going to universities, and generally having just a really great time. So these are images from last year's trip. Our colleagues and friends at Seoulbridge Business School in Korea, the gang from last year, some of you are here. We had a really fantastic time, like I said, going to all sorts of cultural sites, eating all sorts of Korean food. How many of you know Gangnam style? Psy, some of you probably, right? So we got insanely lucky. He actually ended up performing on a day that we were there, and everybody on the program got to go see him. Really sort of phenomenal trip. And this is going to happen every year as part of the Global Innovation and Entrepreneurship Practicum course. So I really hope that in just those few minutes I had, I convinced more of you to consider entrepreneurship and the minor, and hope that I might see some of you in class next year. Okay, and then without further ado, I can't wait to introduce Kevin Cleary. Kevin is a results-driven leader who has an exceptional track record, and it's really exceptional, of success at private and public companies. His focus on vision, going to this idea of having a theory of the case, understanding how innovation works as you understand it, having a vision for how those things work, and strategy, how you're going to execute, is complemented by his effectiveness as a team builder, Teams are so important. I think Kevin's going to talk about that. He believes building a strong culture is the key ingredient to long-term success. Currently, as principal at Big Rock Growth Advisors LLC, he's dedicated to helping CEOs and companies drive and manage growth while developing healthy cultures to ensure long-term success. Again, the idea of a culture enabling long-term success. Much of his advisory work is in leading organizations through strategic planning processes while also helping them create highly effective C-suite teams. Previously as CEO at Clif Bar & Company, Kevin was instrumental in building Clif from a small company to a leader in the healthy snack food category. With a relentless focus, again, on strategy, execution, and culture, he built a multiple bottom-line organization that won awards for green business, great places to work, and sustainable agriculture. During his tenure, and there's going to be a quiz on this next bit after after all this, during his tenure at the company as president and CEO, the company had a compounded annual revenue and EBIT growth rate of 17% and 19% respectively. That's awesome. I'm going to quiz you on what EBIT is and all that afterwards. He also spearheaded innovation that resulted in greater than 20% company revenue, opened a couple bakeries, and expanded the business globally. Earlier in his career, he was a senior vice president in R.R. Donnelley, a big, huge, gigantic printing company, running one of the book printing companies while also leading a strategic reorganization initiative within the company, which was valued at around $5 billion. Prior to that, he was with Quaker Oats in various capacities in sales and marketing. So he holds an MBA from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University and a BS from Berkeley, right across the bridge. He's married and has three sons, so he spends a lot of his time coaching his sons' baseball and basketball teams. He's a three-time Ironman finisher. I mean, that's three times. That's amazing. And a five-time marathon finisher, and was a participant in American Ninja Warrior in 2015. So without further ado, I hope you all offer a very warm welcome to Kevin Cleary.
Are we good? Yeah. Hey, oh, I need the clicker as well, I think. Oh, there you go. Thank you. Hey, it's great to be here. And my feedback number one for me, I got to shorten that bio. It's too long, right? You were getting ready. That was the first thing you were going to write, huh? Bio's too long. All right. Anyway, hey, it's a real honor to be with all of you today. And thank you for spending your Thursday night with me. Always been a big fan of this school. I grew up in Novato. I live in Novato now. And this place has always held a special place in my heart. So I'm going to share with you today some of my lessons over my 35-plus year career. There's seven of them. I love them all the same. Maybe, maybe not. You'll hear as I go through them. But this is, I want to talk to you about it, and hopefully some of these land with you, and they're things that you can build on for your future, and you can think about as you go. So one thing he said there was that I went to Berkeley and then to Kellogg, which is Northwestern MBA. And when I was coming out of high school, I had a 3.0. I wasn't a great student. My SAT scores sucked. They weren't good at all. But I was like, I came out and I wanted to go to Berkeley. Well, how do you go to Berkeley with a 3.0 and a GMAT score? I mean, an SAT score that's not very good. How do you do it? Huh? You go to community college, right? You go to community college because back then, like it is now, you don't get in there with a 3.2. So that was the first thing. The second thing then is I go to Kellogg. I end up going to Berkeley after junior college. Then I go to business school. I work for about 6-7 years. Go take my GMAT. What do you think my GMAT score looked like? Not great, right? It wasn't a great score either. But I'm like, God darn it, I want to go there. I want to go to Northwestern. I didn't get in. So what I did is I kept working for another 6-8 years and then went back in my mid to late 30s through the executive program to get an MBA. And the reason I tell you this is that life in business is an act of will. What does will mean? What do I mean when I say will? Anybody know? Let me tell you, it's a faculty by which someone decides and initiates action. And I'll put the last word on there is undeterred. So it is someone decides and initiates action undeterred. That's what got me into that. And this thing about will ran through my career, and we'll talk about it as we go. But that's the first lesson that I learned in a big way, was that business, if you want something to happen, you have to will it to happen. And in life, you have to will it to be happen, whatever that might be. All right, so as he mentioned, late 80s, I worked for Quaker Oats Company. Everybody know Quaker Oats? Yeah, Quaker Oats Company. I went through sales and marketing roles there for about 11 years. And then I left and I went to R.R. Donnelley, that big, big printing company, and was able to leverage something, new industry, and it was a really cool part of my development. But as I got later into my career at R.R. Donnelley, I started to feel a little empty. I was leading, I was growing in these companies, I was getting promoted. As you heard, I was a SVP running one of their book divisions. But something was missing from me, right? I love leading, I love that aspect of it, but something wasn't happening for me. So I come out to Cliff Bar, a friend of mine. These are two $5 billion companies, Quaker Oats and R.R. Donnelley, public companies. So I come out and I have this opportunity to go to Cliff Bar. So I come out and interview. Cliff Bar at the time is a $100 million business. This is back in 2004. Business is flat. We're not growing. We're missing bank covenants, which means the bank could call a note, which could change the ownership of the company. So things weren't great. But I came out and interviewed with them. And all of a sudden, I heard what the mission of the company was, the purpose, why they were in business. And they were in business to not just drive a profit, right? Because with public companies, at the end of the day, they may talk about mission and vision, but at the end of the day, what's the number one thing you're accountable for? Driving shareholder value, right? That's what they want from you. That gets kind of empty after a while. Well, at Cliff, what we were trying to do, and what I learned, was trying to sustain our business and brands, but our people, community, and planet. Think about that. Every day you're going to work at a public company like one of these companies, and you're really trying to create value for some shareholder you don't know. Versus being a part of a business driving, yeah, some shareholder value, but also doing it in a way that delivers for community, planet, and people. Which one sounds more attractive? First one? No, the second one, right? So my advice to you and my lesson learned was, find your purpose. What do you want out of your life and out of your career? It took me like 15 years to figure it out. I was 38 when I figured it out, when I went to Cliff. So I was 38 years old, and I'm like, okay, I found it. At least I found it. So my encouragement to you guys is, find your purpose. Think about it. You don't have to have it by the time you leave here today. Some of you may already have it. But think about, what do I want out of my career? And what's going to be my purpose? And what mark am I going to leave? And it doesn't have to be running a multiple bottom line business, but what is it for you? All right. So I joined the company in 2004. 2005 to 2009, we are rolling. How many of you have had a Cliff Bar? All right. Good. Good work. 2005 to 2008, the business is rolling. So how big was the company when I joined? It was 100 million. So by 2008, we're at 250 million. Things cranking, we're making money, business is going great, right? So all of a sudden, 2009 comes around. Things just don't last, they just don't roll like that forever, right? Well, 2009 rolls around and I get a call from my head of food safety. It was an anniversary just over this past weekend, because it was on President's Day, that Saturday morning, sleeping in, gonna have a good time with my wife and kids that day, and I get a call. You don't want a call from your food safety person when you're in food. And she says, Kevin, we got a problem. One of the companies that we bought peanut butter from is recalling their product because of salmonella. So I remember, I start shaking. I get nervous when I think about it now, because it was not a fun time. So we go, I go over, and sure enough, we have to recall all this product. We never found it in our product, but that doesn't matter with salmonella. If you were shipped product that was potentially contaminated, you're doing a recall. So we go out and do this recall. And I get on the, so I get my management team together. I'm like, hey, who's done this before? And it's crickets. There's about seven of us in this room. And I'm like, who's done it? None of us have done it. I'm like, ugh. Oh boy. Well, we're going to make this up. We're all good. We can figure this out. We'll make it happen. So we start going. So I get on the phone with Costco. Everybody knows Costco, right? I love it too. They are a good, tough, fair customer. Love doing business with them. So my head of sales and I get on a phone call and we call them and we say, hey, we need to recall this product and we need you guys to make it happen. And how do we do this? How do you think he responded to that? Right? Not well. This guy deals with companies doing this all the time. And I come at him hot and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Right? Me and my head of sales, we've never done this before. We're trying to figure this out. So we come at him that way. He comes back and he is just cold, kind of mean, directive, and just like immediately gets off the phone. Tells us, you guys aren't figuring it out. You got to do this. Go to the site, make it happen, and figure it out. So the next day I get on the phone with him. I call him back and I'm like, hey man, my bad. We don't know what we're doing. We're trying to figure this out. And my mistake was, we were just trying to bluff our way through this, but we need help. How do you think he responded to that? Yeah, he looked at, his tone changed immediately. Oh, hey, in that case, let's do this, 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 and this. I'll take care of number three for you. You guys send this in. I'll try to minimize cost as much as possible for you. So what do you think lesson number three is? Oop. Have the courage to be vulnerable. If there's one thing I'm going to pass along to you, this is maybe one of my favorite childs here. This one is ask for help. You would not believe how far it goes to be vulnerable, to say, I don't know. You can think it makes you look weak, right? It doesn't make you look weak. It makes you look strong. There were plenty of times I was up in front of Cliff Bar. We had like 1,200 people in the company when I left, and somebody asked me a question. I go, that's a question. That's a great question. I do not know the answer to that. We got to figure that out. That's okay. So be vulnerable to ask things. So, hey, so the business is on fire, but we're still not out of this recall thing because I've got 5 million in inventory. So 40% of our business comes off the shelf for 2 months, 2 to 3 months. Now, the problem is you start producing it, and what happens? When you produce it, you sell it. Everybody wants it, and it just starts going because it's really hard to get out of that issue. But we had $5 million in inventory that was sitting at another facility owned by the same company that shipped us the peanut butter that was contaminated. On one side, I need that $5 million in inventory because I need to start making money, right? How are we going to pay our bills if I can't get that money? So there's 5 million inventory. But on the other side, there's a potential that this facility is run like the other one and that there's an issue with this inventory as well. So what do you do? If we ship it and it gets recalled, we got the risk of consumers, right? And then the second thing is if we have to go through another recall, the business is done. So what do you do? Which one do you go? Hands, hands, hands. How many would say, ship the stuff? How many would say, don't ship the stuff? Some of you would be like, whatever, I'm just going to sit here and let it work itself out. All right, so what we did was we didn't ship it. And the lesson here is have the confidence to do what's right. That became a mantra for me at Cliff. Whether we're dealing with a consumer issue, a customer issue, whether I was dealing with an employee issue, we always said, don't do what's easiest, do what's right, always. And we ask ourselves that all the time. And in this situation, it was a real gut check time to do what's right. And the right answer was get rid of that inventory and let's not hold it anymore. All right, so about this time, right, we've got, we are, the company's getting big. I told you it's 250 million. We're now not a company of 75, 80 people. We're now a company of 200 people. Culture's starting to change. So what is culture, right? A lot of times people say it's how things get done when people aren't watching, right? There's a lot of different definitions of it. The one I like and the one I kind of always come back to is that my definition of culture is the fact that it's the behaviors that that people in the organization exhibit and how they interact with one another. That is for me what it is. So I asked 11 people at my company. I said, I want you 11, all different tenures, all different levels, all different functions. I said, you 11 go across and you tell me what it felt like to be on somebody you admire at Clif Bar, a great team you were on at Clif Bar, or a great meeting you're in. What were the behaviors that were happening? They came back to me and completely blew me away. And there were these five ingredients, we call them, behaviors. It was create, inspire, connect, own it, and be yourself. So we started to embed those things in our culture. We put them into our objective setting. We put them into our reviews, right? We talked about this stuff all the time. My guys would give me feedback. My leadership team would give me feedback and say, God, Kev, you weren't very inspiring in that meeting. But that's the kind of culture, right? And I wasn't sometimes. And I needed to hear that. And then I'd also give them feedback in that way. Because you know what the number one career stopper is? How many think it's technical skills? Like, I just didn't have the skills to do that job. How many think it might be leadership skills? The ability to motivate, the ability to get people going. It's the second one, right? And the problem is most companies don't talk about the second one because it's hard to talk about. It's the most challenging thing to discuss. It's easy to say, hey, you missed your number. It's not easy to say, man, I didn't really like the way you showed up in that meeting. So this one is build culture around behaviors. Figure out what the behaviors you want in your company, or what they are in a company that you're working for, and deliver against those. And I gotta tell you, there were times I sat up in front of the company and I said, hey, my bad, I made a big mistake here. There was a time I asked for feedback, this one woman on the team gave me feedback, I came back at it real aggressively. 3 days later at a company meeting, I apologized to her, said, that's not me living these values. But that was also number three there, right? It was vulnerability, and it was demonstrating that we're all not perfect. All right, so how many of you, speaking of culture, how many of you have ever heard the phrase that it's not personal, it's just business? It's in movies, you hear it sometimes, and you'll even hear it actually in business. Like when you're doing it, somebody will say, hey, it's not personal. What do you think of that? I spend 70% of my waking hours 5 days a week at the company. I'm going through all sorts of life's events at the company. And you're going to tell me it's not personal? No way, man. It is personal from word go. And I had a lesson very early in my career. Or not my career, in my life. I was 15 years old. I was playing football. And as a sophomore, I'm playing, and I was considered the worst kid on the team. I wasn't, at least I didn't think I was, but I came back and I said, you know what, I'm gonna try out for varsity the next year as a junior. That was will, right? That's like, I'm gonna go do that, and I'm gonna go try and start on that team. So we get down this path, and I'm sitting out front, there's 15 of us. This is 43 years ago. I remember it like it were yesterday. We're all lined up. There's 15 guys. Al Scott, great guy, great coach. Didn't know him that well at the time. He starts going through naming every guy. He gets to me. He's coming to me, and I'm getting nervous because I'm like, this guy does not know my name. He doesn't know my name. And this is going to be embarrassing. So I try to jump in and say, hey, Kevin Cleary. And something happens. It gets jumbled, and pretty soon he's like, and who are you? And all the other 14 guys are cracking up, right? They're laughing. So how tall do you think I felt? Right? Didn't feel good. But it was an awesome lesson for me. And it's one that I cherish to this day. Was I made a conscious decision right then to know everybody's name. That became my thing. And when I was a CEO, I knew the company was at 450 people at one time, and I knew every name. And I didn't even know just every name. I knew something special about them. Maybe it was the fact that they were, Sidonia loved, was a black belt in karate. Or Rick's daughter was getting married. So when I got up in front of the company to speak, the connection wasn't a CEO to a team. It was Kevin to Rick. It was Kevin to Karen. It was Kevin to, because there was a personal connection there, which drives trust and drives connection and drives effort and commitment from the teams to make your to make the company roll. So it's personal. Can you think about when you're walking through a company and somebody says your name and you didn't think they know it, or you're walking for a teacher comes in, how does it make you feel? How's it make you feel? Really good, right? What goes through your mind when you hear it? I'm what? Special. I'm special. I'm important. I matter. That's what this is about. It's about making people feel connection to an organization and to you and commitment. All right, last one. This one, I know I said the other one may be my vulnerability, maybe my, or will, I don't know. This one might be my most special, and that is own it. What I mean by own it isn't, well, you can go out and own it, like you're talking about being, but this is just owning your work, being accountable, right? Being responsible for the, if you commit to somebody, you get it done. If you make a mistake, what do? You own it, raise that hand up. Hey, that was my bad. This one to me is the very most important. I coach football now in high school, and I coach basketball in high school. And one of the things, I'll sit there and I'll give a guy feedback. I'll say, hey, when you're running that route, do it this way. Make the move here. You got to drop the hips. Oh, no, coach, I just slipped. Ugh. Like, just own it, man. There's no reason to say, thanks, coach, got it. I'm listening. I'm gathering that in. I'm gonna make that change, right? You can tell then, and this is the one, it is the limiter to careers. You got to take accountability for stuff. At Cliff Bar, this one I preached. It was one of those five ingredients, those behaviors I talked about earlier. This one I preached and I got deep with. And when we had a mistake, we had this $5 million mistake happen in the company. Significant. Right from our bottom line, coming off the top. And I look at it and I'm like, ay. Of course I'm frustrated. Most important thing was, I wanted to see how the organization reacted. And I wanted to see if people started finger pointing. Because if you're finger pointing, it's over. If your culture's that way, it's done. First thing, this woman comes in, Kim. She comes in, great employee. She goes, Kevin, I'm really sorry. I own this one. And here's what happened. Here's why it happened, and here's what I'm changing so it doesn't happen again. Conversation lasted about a minute and a half. And I said, fine, great. You're good. Because that's the type of culture. Nobody's perfect. None of us are going to be perfect. But what I encourage you to do, and this one has never failed me in my career, was owning it. No matter how big the problem was. And I didn't get it as I was coming up through the organization. I'd raise my hand on something. I'd say, yeah, that was my bad. And I'd get kind of rewarded for it. I didn't realize it until I was managing people how powerful that is when somebody says, that was my mistake. Because then you're like, wow, okay, this guy's on it. Or this girl's on it. Or this woman's on it. We're going to make it happen. All right. So what happened to Cliff Bar? So I went from 2004 to 2018. We were 100 million. These leadership principles that we were able to embed through an awesome team of both leadership team as well as organization, build it over to over $1 billion in 14 years. Pretty good. And the profit percent, you know, the EBITDA, the margin at the bottom, grew at a faster rate than the sales did. And it was through a lot of these leadership principles, things like will, purpose, vulnerability, do what's right, build culture. It's personal, connect with people, and own it. Those were the underpinnings of the success. And the beauty of these things is that not one of them talks about you got to be a great financial wizard, or you've got to be an amazing strategist, or you got to be technically amazing. Yeah, those things are important, but what makes a difference are these things. That's what makes a difference in an organization and a company. And that's what'll make a difference in your careers, is to identify and latch on to these, to some of these things, the ones that resonate with you, and drive it forward. Because at some point, technical skills, you know, the skills about math, the skills in technology, skills on supply chain or selling or negotiation skills, they all even out. At some point, everybody gets to a pretty similar level. And what differentiates is how you show up every day and how you get work done. So, there they are. And I am really passionate about these things. Hopefully you can get that in the communication of me talking about. But what I ask you to do is understand that life and business is an act of will. That you're in control of this thing. That find your purpose. Find out what makes you tick. How do you want to make your mark on this organization or in this world? Have the courage to be vulnerable. Ask for help when you need it. Just raise your hand and say, hey, I need help. I guarantee you that one will pay back major dividends for you in the future. Have the confidence to do what's right always. That guy who shipped that product out that I told you about, the peanut butter, he knew it. He knew it. Guess where he is today? He's in prison. People died from not doing, this is a true story, from not doing what's right. Boy, I bet you right now, he'd look back at that and say, don't ship it, just, let's just hold on to it. I'll deal with the $2 million issue. Do what's right always. Build culture around behaviors. You're a big part of that. It is personal, like we discussed. And then lastly, please, please own it. All right? Hey, it's been a pleasure. And I'm going to get a chance now to, answer questions, whatever's on your mind. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thanks so much. Yeah. That was brilliant. Remember those. What I want to do now is invite Zay Carter up here to introduce the, who is your co-president, yeah, of the BSA? Yeah, to introduce the rest of the BSA. And then we're going to have some questions with them up here on the stage. Yeah, right on. So, Zay, over to you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Okay, I got it. Get ready for an, I'm Zay. I'm the co-president of BSA this year. This is my other co-president, Ethan. Get ready for an epic semester. We've got a game night where you can crush in like Cards Against Humanity and like Xbox. We'll have rooms for that set up here in Guzman Lecture Hall. I think someone mentioned Just Dance in the middle of the planning. I'll be there to beat the competition. Plus, we also have dodgeball to dodge the stress before finals. probably in either Guzman Lecture Hall or in Conlin. So we'll let you guys know with updates if you're not already following BSA Instagram. And for the BizBass, we have a showcasing of like a fashion show with a lineup of faculty and staff. Volunteers are welcome. Yeah, that's gonna be on BizBash, which I believe is April 25th. Thank you, Julia. And yeah, that's all happening in April. We'll shoot out dates, but definitely be at BizBash on April 25th. You guys look so well-dressed tonight. One more thing. And if you guys need anything for like business or if you have questions about BSA, me, Nathan, or you guys, you can just find us in school or in class, or you can hit up our emails too. Thank you, guys.
So I'm Ethan, as you already know from Zay's presentation. I'll be speaking along with Zay and a few of our other team members. Zay Carter, you already met him, obviously. Then Augustus Muse, stand up. Come.
Augustus!
Then Morgan Newkirk, a sophomore. On the female lacrosse team. Kendall Weatherford, who's also on the lacrosse team, who's a freshman.
Yeah.
And let's get ready for our questions.
All right. Are you going to
get up
there?
Yeah.
You can come
right.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking, Zay.
Before we start, we thought you might want a snack.
Well done.
Nailed it.
Thank you. It's my son's favorite flavor. Thanks. Yeah. Very nice.
Great talk.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for being here. Yeah. We're really grateful. We can't wait to hear all the wise things you have to teach us and take notes, guys. Yeah. I wish I could take notes. These are my notes. So my first question for tonight is, how do you find the balance between working full-time and coaching your son's basketball team?
Yeah, so I one of the things that was, I had kids a little later, right? I had the kids a little later, but one of the things that was important to me, and this just becomes one of those act of will things was, is that okay? Echoing a little bit, yeah, is that it became really important to me that I was going to be involved in my kids and my family's life. So, you know, one of the things that I used to do with the company was, and this was not just when I was CEO, which was a little easier in some regards, because you're like, well, here's how I'm going to work, and here's what you build around it. But even as I was coming up, what I always made clear to the team and the company was that the work's going to get done. First thing is focus on the important stuff at work. Like that was something that I was pretty good at. There's plenty I'm not good at, but that was one of the things I was pretty good at, was focusing on the stuff that mattered. Because a lot of people get caught up in doing things that just don't matter at the end of the day or don't move the dial. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the time I spent coaching baseball, football, basketball, whatever it was the only time in my day I didn't think about work. When I hit the field with the kids for baseball, because I coached all through Little League, it'd be 2 hours, and I wouldn't think about work. It was magical. So the key things are focus, make it a priority, share with your boss and your leaders that this is what drives you and motivates you. And I found that combination of things to be very, very powerful.
What was it like introducing Cliff into the global market?
So, so we, it's hard. I mean, it is really hard, particularly when you're dealing with a product. We took out the vitamins and minerals out of it, but when you were dealing with vitamins and minerals, even in the EU, you had to check with like a whole bunch of different countries to make sure that your product met their FDA standard, right? Like we have here. And that was a real challenge. And you know, it's a really hard endeavor because you build a product for a certain clientele here. We built the product for people on bikes, right? Or people running, doing exercise. That's where it started. And then it broadened, the usage broadened to people eating it for breakfast or people eating it for lunch or people eating it between meals. And it was built, Americans snack a lot and they snack differently than other countries do. So when our bar landed there and it was 68 grams, it was too big. So we shrunk it down, but in shrinking it, it also, our economics got all thrown off because we were still producing it here, shipping it there. So it's really hard and you have to fully commit to it to make it happen. And we did okay with it, but it was never a big part of that $1 billion. Yeah.
I know we didn't really touch on this, but it did mention your bio about the Iron Man and American Ninja Warrior. So I was just wondering, how has your dedication and self-discipline while training for those kind of helped you with the business leader that you are today?
Yeah. Okay. Who watches American Ninja Warrior? Cool show, right? So I'll just tell a quick story on that. So I'm being interviewed. I'd given a talk down at Intuit. I'm giving a talk, and they say, "Hey, what's your favorite television show?" It was ABC or something like that. I said, "It's not on your network. It's American Ninja Warrior." As soon as it came out of my mouth, I'm like, "They're gonna call." Just being CEO at a company, an outdoor company, you know, and energy, that sort of thing. So of course, like a week later, they call and they're like, "You want to be on the show?" And I'm like, "Yeah, like of course I do." So we had to go through a bunch of sending in stuff. So if anybody see me on the show, good. So I was this close to winning it. I'm joking. I went out on the second obstacle, the first thing. It was a tough thing. But no, the thing I learned from those, from whether it was Ironman or marathons or American Ninja Warrior, was the word I didn't talk about here, but is underneath the word act of will, like it's there, is discipline. Like that's, you know, you can't finish an Ironman if every day you're going out drinking or you're eating lousy food. Like that's just not going to work. So you have to be disciplined. You got to get up on Saturday morning and ride 100 miles. You got to get up on Sunday morning and run 18. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And that level of discipline throughout my life is what I brought to business. And when I talk about focus as a way to enable greater flexibility in your life, it comes back to that. Like it's being disciplined to the things that I need to do. And when I'm at work, I'm going. So, yeah.
Thanks. So you gave us a lot of pointers in the beginning or your entire presentation, but I'm curious about what was a pointer or a piece of advice that you were given when you were our age that really just stuck out to you and is still something that you're living by today?
Yeah, so there's two things. One came from my mom, which I hadn't even really connected till I started thinking about that question. Was my mom used to use this thing when I was like 12, 10, 13, 14. Like, if there's a will, there's a way. And you know, the first time it hits you, it's like, okay. The 17th time it hits you, the 25th time it hits you. But there was a lot of magic in that, and she was right. Where there is a will to do something, to initiate action, there is a way to get it done. And so that was the first piece. The second piece came when I was 27. I was a district manager. And these are the moments that are etched in your mind, right? I was 27, I was a district manager. I was hell on wheels. I was on top of, I had 10 people working for me, and I was like, not looking over their shoulder, I was sitting on it. What are you doing? What'd you do today? How'd the meeting go? Not good. So I went and talked to, I went to this training workshop. It was a week long. And this one guy who was a line operator in one of our facilities said, "Kevin, I love your leadership, but sometimes, man, it is too much. You get on something and you get going." And I carry that with me to this day. And it was amazing feedback. Of course, I first heard it. I got bitter. I was kind of pissed off. I was kind of like, didn't manage it well. But then I quickly got over it and acknowledged, like, man, what owned it. And like, great, great comment.
Out of the three, which one was harder to do? Being president and CEO of a company, training for American Ninja Warrior and Iron Man, or being a dad?
They're all different. Being a dad is by far the hardest because there's just so much emotion wrapped up in it. There's so much, there's so many mistakes they're making that I'm making, that my wife's making. It's just like it's a big thing, but they all have their moments. But being a parent is by far been the most rewarding and the most challenging thing I've done.
Thank you. What is your favorite aspect of seeing the growth of the companies that you have helped?
So now in my work today, the last 5 years, I sit on a few boards, and then I also work with mostly privately held companies that are a lot family run or founder led. And I help them kind of figure out the challenges of today. Because a lot of these, I've made a ton of mistakes at Clif Bar, a ton of them. And it was really helpful for me to share those mistakes with them. Some of the things that work, but a lot more of the mistakes. And what's super rewarding is just seeing the growth of them both as leaders, their leadership teams, watching them grow as leaders, watching the business grow, and watching the company evolve. I mean, that's what really gets me going these days.
So on that topic, do you see a difference in leadership between public and private organizations? And if so, how do you approach those differences?
Yeah, it's there is a difference because public companies, as you guys, I'm sure, are learning or have learned or will learn, what's unique about them is it's on a quarterly basis. You're showing how your results are. At a private company, you're not bound by that. You're not bound by quarterly reports. There were times when I was at Cliff, I'd call the owner and I'd say, hey, I'm gonna make this decision. We're gonna miss, our EBITDA profit target by X million. Good? Yeah, go. That was like my board meeting. And literally, it was that fast. Well, in a public company, you're going through all sorts of deals, and then you're talking to the street, and then in between that, you're like, we can't lose that many million dollars. We got to cut programs and do things that, for the long term, aren't good for the business. So I think there are inherently different opportunities at public versus private, being more flexible, although sometimes a challenge in private is cash flow and money and funding, which can be its own limiter. But the thing I'd say in a public company is it can be done. This guy, Paul Pullman, who was with Unilever for years, was somebody that brought those multiple bottom lines like community, planet, and people to the forefront in his business and ran his business as a public company. But it takes a lot of guts, and it takes a lot of courage to do it. So differences, but can be done.
I'm just kind of curious, you mentioned you work at Quaker Oats and then obviously Clif Bar. What kind of drew you into the food industry, based on maybe like previous work or someone that you knew?
Yeah, my dad worked for Del Monte. Del Monte canned foods, vegetables, all that. For I don't know, 30 years, he worked for them. And then my older brother started working for Del Monte at a time in marketing. And so food became kind of just inherently what I was attracted to. And the second part of that about health food was my dad at 47 had a bypass surgery. Diet wasn't great. 47 is young for that, right? And had a bypass. Fortunately now he's, 35 years later, so is that right? My math, 45 years later. He's 92 now and healthy, but he changed his whole diet and that had a major impact on me. And from that time, I started eating differently. And so I got really attracted to the natural and healthy food industry. And that became a big part of, but that was the impetus. Food, my dad and brother, and then health food from my dad and the challenges he had.
So you've clearly done a lot in your career. Good, all the awesomes. But I'm curious, how do you measure success? Like in a professional manner and in a personal manner, just being at home, being a dad, being a husband?
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to go on that one. And I think they're fairly similar, both on the professional and personal side. And for me, it's having a positive influence, right? On business and people, when I'm there working with people, it's having a positive influence. It's having a being able to have an impact and help people along and see their growth at a company, and that's not so different than my family. You know, that's about hopefully having a positive impact and influence and setting a good example in both environments. And then with a touch of joy, right? Like a lot of joy in both of those endeavors, because it's not like every day home's like you're bouncing off the wall saying this is the most awesome thing ever, or at work are you saying this is the most awesome thing ever. But the general arc of it is that, wow, this is really good, man. I'm digging this. This is a lot. I'm getting a lot of satisfaction and joy from it. And what I'll tell you is, if you're in something where you're doing it for a paycheck, stop doing it. Well, maybe not right then. Find something else. Keep getting paid, but find something that's your passion and your purpose.
Did you have any struggles in your transitions from CEO and president at Cliff Bar to principal at your new job?
Yeah. So one of the things I do is I love leading teams and companies. Like that was my thing. And the first meeting I'm in as an advisor, the CEO's on the call with a bunch of his whole leadership team, and they're explaining this one issue, and I'm listening and I'm asking questions and I'm kind of driving the conversation. And as we're getting towards the end, I'm like, all right, guys, here's what we're going to do. And I stop myself right as it comes out and I start cracking up and the CEO's laughing. And I'm like, this is me learning how to become an advisor, not a decision maker. And that was a huge lesson for me. It's just different. Like you're advising and you're moving people along, and it's not so different than like with my kids or football team or players. Like you're nurturing them along, but you're not telling them exactly what to go do. So a lot of times I judge myself on how well am I able to, influence, but have them ultimately make the right decision for their business.
Okay, what has been your favorite part and greatest struggles in regards to helping CEOs in different companies and driving them to increase their growth?
Yeah, the greatest challenges, and what's the other part, the greatest?
The greatest challenges in regards to helping other CEOs?
Yeah.
Like your advice that you give to them, and then how do you help them increase their growth?
Yeah. So the biggest challenge is a lot of times communicating in a way that they can hear it, right, and accept it. Is because sometimes it'll be crystal clear to me what needs to happen and be done, and maybe I'm right, maybe I'm not, but it's like helping them understand it, and it's not their problem, it's mine. Like, how do I actually communicate it in a way that they actually grasp and get it? And that's a big challenge. But but usually in that journey, oftentimes as we're going down that path, we'll end up in a different place than what I originally thought we should do by going through that process. So for me as a CEO, it's a hard thing to learn, because you gather information, you make a decision, you say, here's what we're going to go do. It's a harder thing, but it's something I've learned, and patience and slowing down is critical.
What was it about Cliff Bar in specific that drove you to go work for that company?
Yeah, I mean, Cliff Bar, there were a few things. One was I was doing a lot of triathlons. I was eating the product, loved the brand. And when I heard about the mission of the company and what the company was about, those five aspirations, you know, sustaining business brands, but people, community, and planet, and building that into our articles of incorporation as a business, so we were actually legally bound to make decisions that benefited all five of those things, that's what got me going. And that's what drove me to Clif Bar. And it was the best decision I ever made. I mean, it was an awesome experience, both professionally and personally, to be along that journey about learning about health food, learning about all aspects of the business. Sometimes painfully, like during a food safety incident, but all the time, like learning and growing as a leader, and that's what I wanted.
Yeah, kind of going off that, you know, Clif Bar being such a big success for you and everything, I guess, what kind of drove you to change jobs? I know you worked with Clif Bar for such a long time and you really loved the community. So just kind of what drove you to make a change in your life?
Yeah, it was, so it was 2018, and Clif Bar was a ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership program company. That means employees own a chunk of the company, and then the founder owned the other chunk of the company. And, you know, it got to the point where I'd been running the company of the 14 years I was there as for 12 years, as either COO, president, and CEO, whatever it was. And it got to the point where I think we all looked at each other and were like, you know, I think it's time. I think it's time I move on and that we bring somebody else into the organization or them. They wanted to come back into the organization. And it was like it was time. And I had done what I needed to do with it. I was extremely, a lot of gratitude toward the company and everything, but it had just become time that it's time for somebody else to lead this. And when you think about companies, public, private, whatever, leading something for 12 years is a marathon. It's a long time to run a company, and most CEOs today in public companies are there for about 3 years. So by the end of the 12th year, it was like, yeah, this is good, man. Let's get some new blood in here. And then COVID hit, and there were a lot of things that happened that drove the business down. But then they came back and sold it for a boatload of money a couple years ago.
So being the president and CEO of a multi-billion dollar company can be a pretty daunting task, but like you mentioned earlier, joy is pretty important to you. So what was your everyday, you got to wake up and you were just like, man, I get to go do that today?
Well, one of them was, I lived in Novato. I rode my bike to work. We were over in Emeryville. So I'd ride over there, which is about 20 miles. And that was the first thing. I was like, you know, because that was like, how do I build in not only the coaching, but how do I build in, I love to stay active, right? So I can always do three things. I could be active, I could, you know, run the company, and I could coach, like, and be part of it. Like, it's always three things that were priorities to me. So that was one thing I look forward to. But what really got me going was just the coaching and was handling the challenges, but also the coaching of the team and the company and leading over that next hurdle or that next mountain that we had to get over as an organization. And that was something that that drove me, that I look forward to. And I used to get fired up when we had an issue. Like when there was an issue, I was like, okay, this is going to be good today. We're gonna get along. We're gonna have great dialogue, intellectually stimulating and solving problems. So, yeah.
My parents are training for a marathon right now. So what was the hardest part of training for Ironman?
Swimming. It's the shortest. I'm not a swimmer, but that was the hardest part. But you know, actually, like, it's really hard, and we talk about discipline, and we talk about planning. Was planning all three of those things is a real challenge, like, because not everything, all of a sudden, work gets in the way, and it's like, ugh, how am I going to get my swim in now? And, like, not becoming overwhelmed and focusing on the big stuff was key. Good luck to them. Yeah, that's good.
Let's open it up to you guys. Yeah.
What questions are there?
Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Questions from the audience. Okay.
Hi, my name's Lucas. What's your favorite flavor, Clif Bar?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, peanut butter, of course. No, that chocolate brownie is one of my favorites that you gave me. That was a good choice. And white chocolate Mac, White Chocolate Mac was a hero. It came out of nowhere, went to number one. You like White Chocolate Mac, good man. Yeah, it's a great product.
All right, oh, where are we? Remind them to speak up. All right, who else has a question? Oh, really, Ozzy, make him run all over the place?
Yeah, I have a question. So what was the number one thing that got you to go up the ranks, like when you switched jobs to Clif Bar? What was the thing that made you stand out?
Outside of my inherent hairdo and good looks? I would say that the thing that stood out were those things up there. The behaviors that I put up there. And in particular, because the combination of those things is somewhat what I define as leadership. And I'd say at the end of the day, it was that probably drove me to where I got to the most. And I'd say if you had to dig in underneath that, it was the act of will, and it was owning it. And taking accountability. And we don't see that enough today, right? We don't see that in the world enough today, in politics or anything. We go on forever about that. But we don't see it. It drives me crazy when somebody won't own something. And like I said earlier, when my football players don't own it, they start running. I'm like, it drives me nuts. It's like, learn it, man. This is the one gift I can give you is own, take accountability for your actions, own your stuff. So I'd say those two underneath the general topic of leadership. And it wasn't, I'll be honest with this, it wasn't because I was the smartest guy at Clif Bar. I wasn't. When I was CEO, I was not the smartest person. I hired a ton of really smart people. And one of them wasn't me, and I recognized, I knew that. But I knew how to get these people together, get the most out of them, and get us all focused in the right direction. And that combination of things is what drove the success. But don't get caught up or ever get insecure that I have to be the smartest in the room. Because I see people like that, and what they end up doing is hiring a lot of people who aren't as good as them. How do you think the business does? Not so good. At my end at Clif, the guy who ran supply chain was better than me. The guy who ran the finance was better than I could have run. The guy who ran sales was better than I could have run it. Across functions, I had people in those seats that were far better at doing those functions than I was. Don't be afraid of it. Makes you stronger.
Actually, I have a follow-up question just from what you were talking about. And it sounds like you had an amazing team at Clif Bar, so maybe this didn't come up, but maybe in one of your other situations. Because you talk a lot about getting everybody going in the right direction. What was your secret sauce to enabling culture shift or enabling like paradigm shift? If one thing had always been done one way, and you know maybe your inner team came up, okay, this is what we're going to focus on. Did you ever come up with resistance? And how did you motivate? Like I don't know, maybe from a process standpoint, you know, that kind of organizational change.
Yeah. So remember when we talked about the behaviors? I call them the ingredients because we're a food company. We use ingredients to make our products, right? So that process, when I picked out those 11 people to go do this, so there's that book. Is it Kotler, Leading Change? I don't recommend a ton of books. That's a book I definitely recommend reading. I followed it almost to the letter. And so I put skeptics on that 11. I put people who are in the audience right now thinking, nah, I'm not buying it. I'm going to be vulnerable. I mean, it's those types that I love, right? Because I wanted them in this process. So I had some skeptics, two or three in the meeting. I had others that did that. So when they came up with it, when we introduced it to the company, these ingredients, I didn't touch it. I didn't do it. It was their work. So I had them get up in front of the company. And all of a sudden, Dylan, this one guy, great dude, really smart and bright, and a skeptic. All of a sudden, Dylan's up in front of them, and they're like, Dylan's singing the praises of these new ingredients, talking about how they matter to him on a personal level and how he's seen them at Clif Bar and how we can get better by activating all five of them. How do you think somebody out there who's another skeptic, well, shoot, man, if Dylan's on board, I guess I'm on board. So it was really engaging all across the company and making sure that skeptics are included because they add value and they add credibility to a process. If there had been a bunch of mini Kevin Clearys on that panel, everybody had been like, oh, great, Kevin's just, yeah, of course, he's fired up and passionate about it. So that's the first thing, was that process. But then the second thing was living by it. And that was my whole point about, I wasn't perfect, but I acknowledged to the company, well, it wasn't perfect. So that's the other component, is you got to make sure that you're living it and that we're embedding it in the organization and having those difficult conversations when somebody's not. And my leadership team wasn't always my leadership team. I had to move through people to get to the company and get the right leaders in.
Awesome, thanks. Any other questions from anyone else in the audience? All right. Okay.
I want to thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you all for a really fantastic set of questions, really inspiring talk. I want to invite you all to spend just a second to see if you can remember what was up there, the seven. And if you can remember any of them, why do you remember it? Think about which one really meant the most to you. I'll give you a second. And then I hope you will join me in one last round of applause for Clevin Cleary and for everybody up here.